Today on the 21st Show, novelist Shelby Van Pelt was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, but now she makes her home in Illinois, in the suburbs of Chicago. Her debut novel, called Remarkably Bright Creatures, is about an octopus who forms a bond with an aging woman still grieving her son's disappearance many years ago. The book has been a huge success, reportedly selling more than 2 million copies. It's also being made into a movie by Netflix. We'll talk with Van Pelt about her life and work. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington-Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And my guest today is the writer Shelby Van Pelt. She was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest and attended college at Claremont McKenna in California. But today, she and her family reside in Wheaton, Illinois. During the pandemic, Van Pelt and the writing partner made a pact to finish their books. The result, her debut novel, was Remarkably Bright Creatures. It came out in 2022, and it's been a remarkable success. To date, the book has reportedly sold more than 2 million copies. Earlier this year, Netflix wrapped production on the movie version starring Sally Field and Lewis Pullman. We originally spoke with Shelby Van Pelt back in October, shortly before the Champaign Public Library hosted an event with her, and we're revisiting our conversation today for the hour. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you think about the program. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. So I know you've been asked this before. I'm going to just start by asking you to just sort of briefly describe the book. I was trying to summarize it myself, and I thought, you know, I think this would be easier. We have the author with us. I'm going to ask her to do that.
Are you asking me for an elevator pitch, Brian? I feel like you are.
That'll do. I know you came from the world of business before this, so we can talk about
that. Yeah, you know, I always say that Remarkably Bright Creatures is, it's a book about an octopus that's not actually about an octopus. It is, of course, partially narrated by a giant Pacific octopus named Marcellus, who is sort of in some ways, a typical curmudgeon, from my sort of author perspective, he's like this kind of all-seeing offstage narrator who adds some punch and some levity and is the keeper of certain secrets, really, in the story. But the story itself really is a story about humans. It's about human things that we all experience, like loneliness and grief and loss, and sort of, you know, how unexpected friendship can, sort of heal those things within us.
How did you come to put an octopus at the center of this story?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I kind of wish I had a better story about this. I wish I was like a marine biologist, which I'm not. do you know that I've never even been scuba diving? I can't even believe I am admitting that. But no, I came to become an octopus fan through YouTube, actually, which is, it feels very modern, doesn't it?
I think that's how most of us became octopus fans, yes.
Well, there's just so much good content out there. And, you know, this was 10 plus years ago when I first started, you know, developing this character and developing this book. I was trying to teach myself how to write fiction. I didn't have any formal writing training. I was sort of at a crossroads in my career. As you'd mentioned, I had this whole other kind of career and job before in business and finance that paid the bills, but didn't really do much to satisfy me, you know, satisfy my soul, so to speak. And at this crossroads, I thought maybe I'll try writing some fiction. And I had no idea what to write about. And luckily for me at that time, I happened to go down this YouTube rabbit hole and watching these videos of octopuses, mostly in captivity, sort of behaving badly, but some in the wild too, behaving badly in the wild, and was just fascinated. And sort of, those two things came together of I'm trying to figure out how to write fiction, how to be creative, and here's a character that I would love to try to embody the voice and embrace this and make, an octopus into a curmudgeon.
As I've been reading Remarkably Bright Creatures, I'm sure you've heard something like this before, but I kind of imagine him in the voice of Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons, if you're familiar with that
Oh.
character. I wonder if you have your own voice, and maybe you can just talk about how you found the personality of Marcellus.
Yeah, Sideshow Bob is a new one. I've never heard that, but I kind of like it. When I was first writing him, I kind of heard him as Stewie Griffin from The Family Guy in my mind,
Yes, yes.
but like a nicer version, not quite as salty as a Stewie Griffin, but definitely that like, why am I here? I'm so much better than everybody else type of attitude. His voice really came quite naturally to me, which is strange because it's so different in some ways, but I don't know. I guess I have a grumpy old man inside me somewhere that just was eager to come out when I was when I was developing his voice. It was challenging, of course, to think about, even within the context of, you're writing a non-human character. It's an octopus. It's not going to be realistic. But I wanted it to feel realistic. I certainly wanted everything that he was doing in his physical world to be possible for an octopus. And within his internal monologue, I wanted, the language that he would use to be reflective of the experiences that he would have had, in captivity. And so I was very, very deliberate with my language there.
Another of the characters in the book is named Tova, a woman, I believe in her 70s, if I remember correctly. Not often the
Yes.
type of person who's given main character energy in stories today. How did she come into this book?
Well, I think that I don't know. I don't know why that is. People of all generations should be given main character energy. I don't know why it is that we always like to read stories about people in their 20s. But so Tova came into the story. She was sort of the first human character that was really introduced. After I had been writing basically this series of like journal entries from this octopus's point of view, and I thought, okay, I need to have a human in here somewhere, just to give him more material, basically. And I thought a lot about my grandmother when I was developing the character of Tova. My grandmother, my grandma Anna, she passed away in 2017, but she and I were very close when I was a kid. We lived next door to my grandparents, and I spent a lot of time at their house. And she was this tiny little Swedish lady, super sweet, but also just super tough, super hardworking, never stood still, was always doing something to keep busy. Usually cleaning or some sort of chore. And she would do things that I didn't necessarily think need to be done, that like did not objectively need to be done because she always just had to have something to do. And so I think I took that worldview, and brought it into a character who would be, at this aquarium doing the cleaning, doing really more than probably needed to be done because she just needed to be in motion. And I think I was also sort of thinking of, spending a lot of time in aquariums at that point because I was trying to research, how do you write an octopus? And so I spent a lot of time just trying to observe octopuses in order to get that right. There's sort of this aesthetic that overtakes you when you spend a lot of time in aquariums, where all of the fish are just in constant motion, but they're not really going anywhere. They're just kind of circling the tank. And so I think I brought this sort of circling the tank mentality into this Tova character, this character that was really, my grandmother kind of at her core. This person who is just sort of circling her tank. She's just staying in motion. She's just staying afloat until change descends upon her, which she knows is going to happen at some point, and she doesn't know what to do when that does happen, when she gets to a point in her life where she needs the help of someone else and she doesn't have anyone left. And she's starting to think about what that looks like, and is really sort of afraid of what that looks like in some ways. And that's the challenge that she has to confront. So that's, I think, how Tova and Marcellus sort of initially were tied together. This idea of being kind of like trapped, kind of static, kind of stuck in one place, circling their tanks, just kind of staring down the reality of what's coming next.
circling their tank, circling the aquarium, which is circular shaped, if I remember correctly from the description.
It
I see
is.
What you did there.
Yes.
Okay. Let me take a moment to remind listeners this is the 21st show. We are speaking with author Shelby Van Pelt, originally from the Pacific Northwest, now resides in Wheaton, Illinois, in the Chicago suburbs. Her book, Remarkably Bright Creatures, has been a huge bestseller. Let's come back to the book a little bit later. You mentioned your upbringing next door to your grandmother. You grew up in the Pacific Northwest. What was your childhood like there?
Oh, you know, it's so funny. I feel like when you grow up somewhere and then you think it's like the worst place in the world, right? You can't wait to get away. And I didn't travel a lot when I was a kid. Pretty much like Western Washington was what I knew, you know, outside of movies and TV. And I could not wait to get away. I fled to Southern California for college. I fled to the sunshine. you know, and SoCal is great. And I've lived all over in between. I've lived in the Midwest, the Northeast. I spent almost a decade living in the South in Georgia and North Carolina. You know, had landed here in the Midwest. My husband's family is from the Western suburbs of Chicago. So this was a very natural place for us to land once we had children. And I love it here. But when I think about, you know, Western Washington and my sort of attitude at 18 of just not, you know, I was like, oh, this place is so small. It's so green. It's so kind of wet. Like, I just can't wait to get away. And now when I go back and visit, I'm like, this is paradise. And it truly is, you know, but you can't know something, I guess, until you know something else. And so I think, you know, for me, I haven't lived full time in Washington State since I was 18, but I go back to visit a lot. And it's just been really, you know, I guess healing for me to like put myself back in touch with my roots and realize that I was wrong at 18. This was not somewhere that, you know, that you want to flee. This place is wonderful. It's beautiful. It's the Pacific Northwest is almost difficult to describe to people who haven't spent time there. You know, everyone thinks, oh yes, Seattle is rainy. And that's true. It does rain a lot. It doesn't actually rain as hard as it does out here. You know, you take a good summer storm in the Midwest, it's going to rain way harder than anything you'll see in Seattle. But you know, everything is that kind of like damp, mossy, ferns everywhere, green and overgrown so beautifully, but almost to the point of being like a little bit claustrophobic sometimes. And so
I've got family in Bellevue and Everett out there. And they sort of chide you for bringing an umbrella. They say, you just need a coat. It's raincoat weather.
No one wears an umbrella. It doesn't ever rain really hard enough to need one. And anyway, yeah, you just put the hood up on your North Face coat and you're fine. It's funny. You walk through like downtown Seattle or Portland or Bellevue, Everett, and you see, you know, the people going to work in their like business suit, then with like a, you know, a rain jacket, like a North Face coat over the top of it. It's very, very typical. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed writing that setting because it allowed me to sort of remember everything that I loved so much about growing up there. It was a wonderful place to grow up.
I was going to say, is that, do you think, part of what drew you to the story of, you know, an oceanic creature like the octopus, not something as familiar to those of us here in the landlocked Midwest?
Well, it's funny. I don't think there ever was another place where this book could have been set. It was important to me that Marcellus, in his captive situation inside this small town aquarium, that he be, you know, mere feet from home. I mean, his home literally is on the other side of this cement wall and across a little, you know, dock. It wouldn't have really worked if he'd been somewhere like the Shedd Aquarium, because an octopus can't live in Lake Michigan, probably. Definitely not.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was just always set there. And, you know, you mentioned that I wrote a lot of this during the pandemic, and I did. I wrote probably the last like 70% of it during the pandemic, which was a time when I felt like I was missing home more than ever. You know, I was not able to go back home and visit and see my family and see my hometown. And I feel like being able to just immerse myself in this world through this story that I was writing was really comforting.
Did you also feel that you were in captivity and maybe swimming in circles endlessly during the pandemic, as many of us did?
It's funny. I remember a specific moment looking out my front window, and we live on a street that is, it's not a cul-de-sac, it's like a dead end, but it goes into a bike path that goes into a park. And so the result of that is that we had almost no car traffic, especially during COVID, but just tons and tons of foot traffic because everyone was out walking their dogs and going for walks. And I would stand at the front window and just sort of like watch this almost like parade of people go by, like dogs that I had never seen before that lived in the neighborhood. And I remember having the distinct feeling that I felt like I was the one behind glass. And so, yes, I think that is definitely a part of it.
So you mentioned you wrote most of it during the pandemic. When did you actually start writing this book?
Oh, like an embarrassing number of years ago. I think it was like 2012 or 13, probably 2013 maybe. Like I said, I was kind of in this career crossroads. I was taking some time away, slash leaving for good this other career that I had had, and really just trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And we had just moved to a new city. We had just moved to Atlanta, and I had the blessing of time, which is, I look back and, not everyone has that. It's a real privilege to be able to have time and explore something like writing, something that is sort of a passion pursuit. So it was a while ago.
All right, we're going to take a break on the program. We'll have more with Shelby Van Pelt when we continue. She's the author of the best-selling novel Remarkably Bright Creatures. We originally spoke with her back in October, just before she was the guest at a Champaign Public Library event. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Support for the 21st Show comes from the Des Moines Arts Center, presenting Manuel Alvarez Bravo, a pioneer of Mexican photography, featuring collaborators like Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and more. On view through January 18th. More information at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening today to my October conversation with a writer who makes her home here in the 21st state. Shelby Van Pelt is the author of Remarkably Bright Creatures, a best-selling novel. Because this conversation's on tape, no calls today, but if you have thoughts, we have email. The address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, back to the conversation. So I'm curious about how your path to writing, right? You said you went to Southern California, Claremont McKenna College. Were you a philosophy major?
I did a major called philosophy, politics, and economics.
Ooh, I like
But
that.
sometimes, it actually originated, I think, at Oxford University
Yes,
was the original program.
I've had their the PPE reading list for Oxford University freshmen on my lifelong reading list. I'll get to it someday.
So my alma mater, Claremont McKenna College, sort of adapted it. Gosh, I think this is, they've probably had it for 20 plus years. And it's a small kind of cohort program that you have to apply to. And there were, I think, 13 of us that were in this cohort together for, 3 years doing all of these courses. And, but, sometimes that's a mouthful. So sometimes I do just say I studied philosophy. Philosophy was my favorite of those three things. And
What
probably,
did you
the
envision you
most.
would be with that, or you would do in
Oh,
life?
gosh. I don't know. So when I graduated, I leaned more into the economics piece of it. And that wasn't something I ever really aspired to do. I never was like, oh, what I really want to do is a lot of Microsoft Excel. It's just not, I can do it and it's fine. Like I'm not bad at it. And it certainly paid the bills, you know, the student loan bills that you graduate with. It was what I needed to do at the time. But you know, I don't I think I always liked writing. I think if I had said, I'm gonna have a writing career, I would have pictured myself probably in something more like journalism or like nonfiction, because I was always good at writing, but I never thought of myself as being creative. It's actually something that I still kind of struggle with. I don't think of myself as being a particularly creative person. It's hard to think of myself as an artist, I guess, maybe coming from this very, you know, kind of practical educational background. But I certainly am happy to have landed here.
Yeah, how many artists can say they can give you an Excel spreadsheet worked up with formulas and everything? So you worked as a financial consultant. What was that like?
It was fine. It was a fun thing to do in my 20s. It was, you know, back, I don't know how it is today, but it was a pretty intense job. It was the sort of thing where you're traveling a lot and you're working long hours and you have sort of a cohort of other 20-somethings and you're going out to happy hour. And, you know, it sort of worked at that time. I try to picture myself being in that industry now, and it's very hard to imagine. You know, and that was one of the reasons why I decided to get out of it. You know, as I got into my later 20s and I got married and I started thinking, okay, what does the next decade of my life look like? It was hard to imagine being in a job where you're getting a call at 5 p.m. that says, oh, by the way, you're on the 10:30 flight out tonight because the client needs you to go do this and that. You know, it's just not super, A, it's not super enjoyable, and B, it's not really compatible with like having a family and you know, being settled. And you know, particularly my husband also was working a job like that, so it was like, okay, we can't both do this, and I am super burned out. I'm ready to walk away from the frequent flyer miles and just do something else. I don't know what, but something else.
Let's say diamond platinum status, not what it was cracked up to be when you were younger, maybe. Yeah.
No, you know, it's not.
So you mentioned it was family that drew you to Illinois. You ended up in Wheaton, Village of Churches. How long have you been in Illinois now?
We moved up here in 2018. We had been living in Atlanta prior to that. And Atlanta was the longest we had lived anywhere, really. We had bounced around quite a bit. But and I loved Atlanta. Atlanta was so much fun. But the problem was we didn't have any family there. We didn't really have any roots there. You know, my husband's job was the thing that had brought us there. And when he decided to leave that job, we kind of there wasn't really anything keeping us there other than the restaurant scene, which we loved. And it seemed natural. You know, our kids, I think, were like a year and a half and 3 at the time, and it was just time to move somewhere to be closer to family and in a place that was a little bit easier to raise kids. When we lived in Atlanta, we were right in Midtown, which, like I said, was so much fun. So many great restaurants in walking distance. But you know, it wasn't like the sort of street that your kid could ride a bike down. It was a bit chaotic. So, you know, we ended up in the suburbs, which, man, I said I would never live in a suburb. I was like, never, ever. And yet here I am. And you know what? It's not bad. It's actually really kind of easy.
Could be worse. Could be worse. All right. I wonder if you've lived here long enough to do kind of an Illinois lightning round.
Oh gosh, I can try.
All
I can
right.
try.
We'll start. Cubs or Sox?
Oh gosh.
And you
Well,
can say Mariners or Braves or whoever you
I
want.
do. I want to say I'm going to say Mariners. No. So I know that Sox is the right answer for being like a Chicagoan. But I have to say, like, if we had friends that were coming into town and I was going to take them to a baseball game, like, I would have to take them to a Cubs game. Like, I just feel like it's a bit more iconic. I don't know.
I'm South Suburbs
But
born and raised
Mariners.
myself, but I can't argue with that, to be honest with you. O'Hare or Midway?
Well, I am in and out of O'Hare more than I would like. I was at a it was a you said lightning round, but I'm gonna
That's
ramble.
fine. This is the point of this, yes.
I was at a book festival up in Harbor Springs, Michigan, with a bunch of other authors last weekend, and it was absolutely lovely. But it's a very, very small airport that you fly in and out of up there, Pellston Airport. And so everyone was flying through Chicago to go where they were going. This entire plane was like full of authors. It was so funny. It was like, please let's not have this plane crash because this would be like an event in the history of
The day
literature.
literature died, yes. Oh, gosh.
But anyway, we were all sitting around this tiny little airport surrounded by taxidermy in Pellston, Michigan. And everyone was like, oh, well, we have this layover. Are there any good restaurants at O'Hare? And I started going terminal by terminal, listing all of the restaurants and telling them, this one's good, this one's not as good. Oh, if you're passing through here, you should definitely go there. Which is to say, people just kind of gave me this look like, you spend way too much time in this airport. And I'm like, yeah, I really do. With all of the book travel, I'm there a lot. So O'Hare definitely has, the better restaurants. But man, any chance I get to go in and out of Midway, like I will take it. It is so easy. Yeah, it's a little bit farther from my house. The distance is not as good, but it's easier.
Good answer. How do you feel about people policing hot dog condiments?
Oh, are you trying to get me? You're going to get me canceled. So I am a ketchup on hot dog person. I'm sorry. I love it.
No, I'm with you on that. I'm with you.
Which is to say, I don't feel good about polygamy. Again, if someone came in from out of town and we were going to do the Chicago thing, I would say after our Cubs game, and we would go out to some bars, and then I'd say, okay, we're going to get a Chicago dog, and yeah, we're going to have it the way with the onions and the mustard, and if you ask for ketchup, they're going to yell at you, and yeah, we'll do that. But when it comes out to, if I just were to eat a hot dog, I would absolutely put like just ketchup on it. I'm happy. Ketchup only.
Yeah, ketchup and a dill pickle spear for me. Deep dish or tavern style?
Ooh, I think that tavern style is pretty underrated. I mean, a good deep dish is good, but it's a different food for me. Eating a deep dish is eating a pizza casserole. It reminds me more of having like a lasagna or something. I have to really be in the mood for it. A cold day, maybe you're kind of cozy and you want something really hearty, then it's really hard to top a good deep dish. But it's just, if I just want a slice, like I would say tavern style.
Can we talk about Eat, Drink, Run? I suspected you might have
Oh
some
my
opinions.
gosh. Talk about a throwback, sure.
Yeah, I mean, so you ran this blog for a long time. I saw it. I came to know of it just as somebody mentioned on Reddit. I think the Chicago Suburbs subreddit. They were talking about you and the fact that your success and you're a neighbor to them, broadly speaking, not one of your actual neighbors. But they mentioned that they enjoyed reading your blog back then. How did that contribute to your sort of development as a writer?
Well, so this was back in the days where this sort of thing was normal. I have to say the concept sounds insane these days, but this was back in the kind of early teens, late aughts, early teens, and it was when there were a lot of food blogs around and a lot of running blogs around, and these people would make these blog posts of here's what I ate today, and like that's it, that's the whole post. Like maybe there's a story around it, but we were all doing this, and for some reason, people enjoyed reading it. And so I thought, well, you know what? I don't really want to do a food blog because I'm not like that much of a foodie. And I followed a lot of running blogs. I was really into running back then. I was a somewhat competitive marathoner. I was out doing, 5Ks every weekend. I was out doing track workouts. I was on running teams. And so I followed a lot of people who were in that space. And I didn't want to do just that either. And so I thought, well, I'll just combine my passions and make this like a food and running, and also I would like blog whatever beer I was liking. I used to drink a lot more beer than I do now. But yeah, so I would just, it was kind of a daily thing, and it still is so fascinating to me that I would basically sit down after dinner and write these posts about like, well, here was my track workout, here were my splits, here's how it felt, and here I had this like I had this American Pale Ale, and here's a picture of it, and it was really good. Here's where I got it. Here's how much it cost. And I would just sit down and write that, and then press publish, and it would go out into the internet. And I think some of it probably is still out there. I don't know. It's been a while since I've checked, but and then there would be some like life kind of stories interspersed in there. But in terms of the content, I think it's probably pretty like banal by today's standards. But again, I was not the only one doing this. I feel like there was this era of this kind of, it went from like LiveJournal into Blogger into, this like daily diary type of blogs. I would say the thing that it really helped me with was it did establish like a daily writing habit. And even though I can't imagine pressing publish on something every single day, like without editing it, it did sort of ingrain in me like, hey, you sit down and you put some words on a page, if not on a daily basis, on like an almost daily basis. And that's a habit that I try to maintain to this day.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. And that's kind of what I was wondering, if there was going to be that connection. So how did you decide to, to go from your running splits and the beer you were drinking to starting to write fiction?
Well, I had kids. And so the running splits kind of went away for a while. They haven't really been back. I don't know if they'll ever be back. The idea of going to a track and running quarter mile repeats for fun just does not sound fun. And obviously I wasn't drinking beer like, and I still am not like I used to. I can't, you can get away with so much when you're in your 20s that just doesn't fly in your 40s.
People in your 20s listening, you have no idea.
You
Enjoy
have
it while
no
you
idea.
can.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Yes.
So, I've never thought of it this way, but I suppose I did. So, and then, well, I guess the other piece of that is, once I had kids, the natural evolution would have been like to make it a mommy blog. And that was a big, big thing at that time. My daughter was born in 2014, and there were a lot of mommy blogs out there. And in fact, a lot of the running blogs and the food blogs that I had followed sort of morphed into mommy blogs as people started having kids. And I remember having a conscious thought of like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to put my kids on the internet every day. I don't really want to write about this. This isn't necessarily what I want to write about. And so I'm just going to kind of wind it down. And I did. I kind of wound it down. But it was really at that same time that I started sort of increasing my investment in writing fiction. So I guess I did sort of trade one for the other in a way. And
How did
that's,
you,
you know what?
yeah.
Writing fiction is better than writing about having small children. There we go.
I'll believe that, having been through that about 13 and 9 years ago, respectively, myself. But how did you get over that? I mean, you mentioned, I don't know if you use this phrase exactly, but that idea of imposter syndrome's out there, right? Like, who am I to be writing fiction? Was that something you had to get over?
Oh, it's something that I still have to get over. And
How
it's,
did you
you
do
know,
it?
in comp
Yeah.
I don't know. In comparing it to sort of the blog days, again, that's the sort of fascinating thing when I think about it, that I was just writing this stuff every day and just pressing publish. And there was no thought of like, who am I to do this? I mean, who cares if anyone reads it, right? It's just you're putting it out there. But then you start to write fiction and you start to try to publish, and it's like, oh, you do start to think of, am I good enough at this? Is someone going to read it? I think at the very beginning, I wasn't thinking that much about it because I never thought it would actually get published. I was just sort of doing it for my own, my own personal growth or my own entertainment. And I feel like in some ways, I battle it now a little bit more. When I sit down to write something, I know that people are going to read it, and I have to get over that hump of, is it good enough? Am I good enough? What did I do to deserve all of this? I mean, these are things that I've never met a writer who doesn't deal with it on some level. Even, my own like writing idols, when I get to meet them and they say that they still deal with this, and it makes me feel a little better that like, okay, this is a very universal problem.
It is a weirdly like self, I don't know if self-punishing is the right term, but like self-doubting field, right?
Well, when you think about, any other area where you're making a product, and even into some other creative areas like perhaps filmmaking or TV, or it's very collaborative. This product is sort of, been created by a bunch of people. But when you're writing fiction, you're literally just pulling things out of your brain and putting them on paper, and it is very, it's like it's all on me as the writer, whether this is good or not. And of course, you have your editors that come in at some point, but in that first stage, when you're just drafting, it does feel very much like it's just on my shoulders alone.
Okay, we need to take another break. We're listening back to my conversation with Shelby Van Pelt. She's based in Wheaton, Illinois, and is the author of the best-selling novel Remarkably Bright Creatures. It's being adapted into a Netflix movie starring Sally Field and Lewis Pullman. We originally spoke with Van Pelt in October, a few days before an event that featured her at the Champaign Public Library. No calls today, but if you want to share your thoughts on future conversations we're planning on the show, one great way to do that is our texting group. And you can join that by sending the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. Once again, just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're hearing from Illinois author Shelby Van Pelt. She's based in Wheaton in the Chicago suburbs, though she grew up in the Pacific Northwest. Her book is Remarkably Bright Creatures. It's been a mega bestseller with more than 2 million copies sold. And Netflix is going to be coming out with a movie version of it starring Sally Field and Lewis Pullman. We originally spoke with Van Pelt in October, so no calls today, but you can share your thoughts about the program, our email address, talk@21stshow.org. I want to talk about the success of this book. I wonder what your expectation was when you work on this for years, you make this pact I read about, correct me if I'm wrong on any of these details, with a writing partner of yours to finish your books, you start shopping it around to agents, and, you know, it gets picked up. There's these deals here. There's deals overseas. And then it becomes, you know, slowly over time, this mega bestseller. What were your expectations going into it?
Well, my expectations when I was drafting it were very low. I mean, again, even as I got to the point where I thought, hey, I'm going to actually query this to agents. I'm going to put it out in the world. You know, being the sort of person I am, I started looking at the numbers. And as anyone who has, you know, spent time in the querying trenches, as we call it, you know, the numbers are bleak, like objectively bleak, right? The number of submissions that agents get versus how many of those they sign on, the minuscule number of them that they sign on as clients, you know, and then even from there, you know, can you get a publishing deal? There's another portion of those that never make it to that point. You know, and even when you look at published books, like most of them are like, they don't earn out their advances. It's just, it's a tough industry. And so I feel like I went into it with, you know, sort of characteristic, like low expectations. I always say I have like one foot in Gen X and one foot in the millennial generation as a 1980 baby. Yes. And sometimes my cynical Gen X side really does take over and just say, you know, okay, good luck with that, you know? So I definitely had that kind of attitude when I was drafting it and getting ready to query it. I think I benefited from a couple things when I did finally, you know, query it in 2020. I was querying it right when my Octopus Teacher, the documentary on Netflix, had come out, and I didn't plan that. It was a lucky stroke that, you know, as right as this thing, you know, this documentary was wildly popular when it came out in the fall of 2020, it went on to win an Academy Award the following spring. And that was when my manuscript was landing on agents' desks and eventually on editors' desks at publishing houses. It was sort of this fiction version of this other thing that had been proven to be popular. And I think it helped a lot, you know. I think in publishing, anything that can sort of mitigate the risk from their perspective is a good thing. And Octopuses were very much having a moment, and I think are still having that moment, which is really fun.
Yeah, if I could just read this line, it was a New York Times story about your success a couple of years ago, and it quotes Kristen Nelson, who I gather is your agent, said my assistant reached out to me and said this query came in today, and it's either brilliant or it's bananas because there's a talking octopus. So it really was this kind of like lightning in a bottle moment, like you say, because this film had come out. So yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
no. So I think, you know, at some point my expectations shifted obviously, once I started getting traction, once, Kristen was actually the only agent that called me back or that, responded. A lot of times when you're querying a manuscript, you're an unpublished author trying to become a published author, and you're just sending these query packages out into like the void. And a lot of times the agents don't even write you back. It's just sort of assume that if you don't hear back, it's a no. And I think I queried, I don't know, a handful, somewhere between, I should look up the actual number. I think it was somewhere between like 6 and 10 agents was like my first batch that I was querying. And Kristen was among those. And she was the only one that wrote me back. And she was like, can we get on a Zoom call this afternoon? And we did. I had to bribe my kids with some snacks and some juice to like stay in the other room while I did this, life-changing Zoom call. And yeah, it kind of at that point it was kind of like, okay, wow, this is actually happening. And my expectations obviously became vastly different from what they had been when I was just writing this ridiculous octopus story and assuming that it would go nowhere. I don't think anyone could have predicted what actually happened, though, which, the book has followed a little bit of an unusual path. It had great success right when it first came out. We hit the New York Times bestseller list that first week, which was fantastic. We came in at number 15, which is, of course, the very last slot. But that doesn't matter, whether you're second or last, you're still a New York Times bestseller. So that was a big cause for celebration. And then it fell off the list and we kind of did what you would expect a book to do. Like, you get that big kind of bump in the beginning from the pre-orders, from I was a Read with Jenna book club pick, so you get a bump from that. But at some point over those weeks, it kind of just it starts to taper off, and it did. But then it had like this resurgence. I think around November of that year, probably around holiday shopping. It was on a lot of best of the year lists. It was on a lot of like holiday gift guide lists, and it started picking up. And since then, it just has kind of stayed up. It very, very unusual. I've had my, the highest sales numbers were, a year plus after publication. It has legs. It has 8 of them. I don't know that I can really explain it. I don't know that even my publishers can really explain it. And it's not for lack of trying. We have sat around and said, hey, is it Book Talk? Is it Bookstagram? Is it booksellers and librarians hand selling it? Is it book clubs? Is it friends recommending it to one another? And I think the answer, it's probably all of those things, but it just has been, truly the wildest ride. And, that's the part of it that I never truly could have expected. Even at that point where I had the agent and I had the publishing deal and I knew that this was going to happen and it was going to probably do pretty well, I never would have expected to still be riding this wave, 3 years later.
It's one of these books where there's so many personal recommendations, right? I've seen you talk about that. I've seen other people referencing that. I was looking online. Even A Tale of Two Cities, one of the great, works of literature. There's 38,000 one-star reviews on that. I wonder if you ever read or engage with the minority of people who, maybe your work doesn't resonate with. Do you think about that, or do you just keep that out of your mind?
I mostly try to keep it out of my mind. And I do like I know a lot of authors who read their one-star reviews and they're quite funny. And I have done that occasionally and they are usually pretty funny. But now that I'm in the process of trying to draft another book, I feel like I need to protect my headspace a little bit. So I don't intentionally delve into those. For the most part, I know what they say, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be for everyone. The truly strange thing is sometimes I will come across some sort of review or comment about my book when I'm just scrolling on something unrelated and someone posts, on my Instagram feed about the book, and then you see people's comments of, well, like, and again, they're like mostly very positive, but then you get the occasional person who's like, "Yeah, man, I hated that book. Didn't see what the hype was about. It's a talking octopus. Who cares?" It's like, all right, well,
Right.
that's not it's not for you. That's fine.
my favorite one, and maybe I shouldn't. It's so silly. Like they didn't. They found it unbelievable that Tova would have brought her own cleaning supplies. Something about that. Like that was their big complaint about the book. Come on.
People have little, and it's so funny. That's why I choose to try to write in fictional towns most of the time, because as soon as you bring in these details, you start to you invite people to disbelieve.
Actually,
in
First
it.
Street doesn't go to all the way to Maine.
Yeah, did you know that there's actually a 4-way stop there? It's not a stop sign.
Right. let's actually, we can get a phone call in here. Cindy is calling from Champaign. Cindy, thank you for calling in.
So I'm actually very much enjoying the program. I actually listened to the book, an audio book, because a book club that I'm not a part of had recommended it. And I was kind of suspicious at first. I thought, what's this going to be like? And actually, I really enjoyed it. I listened to a lot of books because I sew a lot and I do it that way. But I called because I was very amused by your comments about Chicago pizza and your likes. So while you're here in Champaign, you really need to try Papadels. Papadels.
Dells, D-E-L, Papa Dells, yeah.
Oh, Dells, like the Wisconsin Dells.
Yeah, one L, yes. Yeah. I'll email it to you.
Anyway, I was just amused by that, and I thought, you really have to try it while you're here in Champaign.
I have to know, is it tavern style or is it deep dish? What is it?
You can, either one.
Okay.
You can get either one, and you can also get gluten-free, you can get vegan. It's a pretty amazing place that's been here for 50 years, I think. Yeah, long time.
Cindy, incredible. Thank you so much for the call. Appreciate that.
Okay.
What advice do you have for people who maybe, like I said earlier, have that, those pages in the drawer that they haven't touched, or that file on the computer that they haven't touched? Maybe they're not satisfied with their consultant job. What advice do you have for people to actually get started with this?
Well, I think there's two things that helped me a lot. And the first one is realizing that I didn't necessarily have to write a novel. And, I think we touched on this talking about the old blog. the development of a writing habit, no matter what you're writing, is really helpful when you're trying to take on a longer project. But the other part of that I don't think we've really touched on is that, I've written a lot of short stories. I've written a lot of flash fiction. When I was sort of trying to teach myself how to write, to get back into writing, I wasn't always just focused on this novel. I did a lot of these kind of one-off writing competitions where, you sign up for a weekend-long assignment and then give you prompts. I find those even now to be so helpful for breaking through writer's block, or just there's something so satisfying at getting to the end. And when you're writing a novel, it can feel so very far away. But if you're sitting down to write a flash fiction piece, which is typically 1,000 words or less, you can get there in a weekend. And, sometimes you need that to keep going. So, people who say, I want to write a novel, I always say, great, you should absolutely write a novel. But don't be afraid to also write some other stuff to keep you going. And you never know, that material that you're generating, I have taken a lot out of my short stories and my flash fiction pieces and dropped them into novels. There are characters, there are little bits and pieces in Remarkably Bright Creatures that came from some of those writing competitions. So I just think of it, I try to think of it less as like, working on a novel, and more of like you're working on just a body of material of your writing. And, you got to kind of do whatever, if the novel is frustrating you, put it aside, do something else. There's no shame in that. And then, the other thing that really helped me a lot was finding a writing community. And I found that initially through signing up for a class. This was at Emory University, which we were living in Atlanta at the time, but they have them here at College of DuPage. I'm sure that you have them, all over the state, in wherever there's a university, a community college, even a library, like there's probably some sort of class that you can sign up for. And, those classes are great for what you learn. But I think they are just as helpful for the community that you can potentially build out of them. That was how I found my longtime critique partners, was out of that class and out of that community. And it is just, it's so much more fun also to do it when you're doing it with other people. It is fundamentally a pretty lonely job to be a writer, and it is a lot more fun if you have a group of people that you can text and joke around with and lean on. So I would say definitely don't be afraid of short form writing, and find your writing community would be my two big pieces of advice.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time. Shelby Van Pelt, what a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for making the time with us.
Of course. Thanks so much, Brian. This flew by. This was fantastic.
Glad to hear it. That was Shelby Van Pelt. Her book is Remarkably Bright Creatures. She lives in the Chicago suburbs, and we originally aired that conversation in October. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we continue listening back to some of our favorite conversations from this year. It's been 80 years since VE Day, when America and its allies won victory in Europe over the Nazis. We'll talk with Illinois historian Peter Fritchie about the Second World War in modern memory and the lessons some people seem determined to forget. We'd love to hear what you think about what we've been talking about today or any topic in the past. If you liked it, if you didn't like it, you think we got something wrong, or for whatever reason, leave a voicemail. Our number is 217-300-2121. You can call anytime, day or night, 217-300-2121. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.